This is Dylan FM, a Freak Music Club podcast. I'm Bob Dylan. If you love Dylan, you're in the right place. This season, we're going deep on Time Out of Mind to celebrate its 25th anniversary. Here's your host, Craig Danieloff.
For a long time, the best news a music fan could hear was that one of their favorite albums was being remastered. This was done a lot once CDs took over, and the record companies wanted to give us all even more reasons to repurchase things we already owned and loved. A remaster is a new version of an old album. The finished tapes are prepared, usually using far better technology than the first time, for commercial reproduction and distribution. There can be sonic differences, but generally the goal is exactly as it was, only better. A remix is something more dramatic. When an album is remixed, the source track recordings are used, the individual instruments and vocal takes. And these individual tracks can, and often are, modified and then recombined in potentially different ways. And then the combined new result is adjusted in any one of a thousand ways, and then the whole thing gets mastered anew for reproduction and distribution. This is not exactly as it was, only better. Well, it could be that, but it doesn't have to be that. So a remaster is a cleanup, but a remix is, potentially, a complete rebuild. Our guest today was handed the master tapes for Time Out of Mind a little over a year ago and asked to remix it, to build a new version from the source parts for this award-winning and deeply loved album. The result of his work is being released tomorrow on the Bootleg Series Volume 17, Fragments, the Time Out of Mind Sessions. Michael Brower is a New York-based mix engineer with an incredible resume. His credits include Aretha Franklin, The Rolling Stones, Bruce Springsteen, Paul McCartney, and Elvis Presley, to name just a few. The release notes include a much longer list. He's won 7 Grammys. He's also worked on 8 major Bob Dylan albums before this one, and you'll hear about those. And you'll also hear, clearly, that he's a huge Bob Dylan fan who deeply understands the responsibility he holds in doing this job and what the original recordings mean to all of us, as well as the potential for improving, or in this case, reimagining them. He is also very well known and respected, of course, in the mixing world, and he's built plugins that others use to mix, and he teaches mixing both in person and online. I spoke to Michael last week from his upstate New York studio. We talked about what he was asked to do with Time Out of Mind, how he approached it, what he did, and the results he's achieved. This is a side of the music world that we often don't get to look at very closely. And although it's a technical process, this is a conversation about passion, the feelings of the songs, and the Dylan songs in particular bring, and the impact of voice and the totality of the album and its legacy. So now, here's our discussion with Michael Brower about the Time Out of Mind Remix 2022. So it's an amazing pleasure and privilege to have you here, Michael. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. It'll be a fun time today.
Yeah. So let's start with your background with Dylan, because you've done a lot of Dylan, and this is by no means your first Bootleg Series mix even.
No, I met Steve Berkowitz. Well, I've known Steve Berkowitz for many, many years. He was at Legacy. And he hired me for the first bootleg that was, it's right over here. What is it?
It's 66, I think you did
it's
first.
It's a 66. Yeah, I'm looking at the award.
Yeah.
And that was the first challenge. Boy, if I had the technology that I have today, back then it would have probably taken a bit less time and not as frustrating. But still, yeah, so I've done many, many projects that were usually either projects that had never been mixed, where maybe just roughs have been released, or they're remixing it in an SACD format, and each one was a challenge of its own, but really, really fun.
Yeah, well, let me list them. So you did Bootleg Series 4, Live 66, Bootleg Series 5, Live 75, Bootleg Series 6, which was 64, the Halloween concert, which is like my favorite show in all of history. So it's just amazing to get to listen to that. 7, the No Direction Home box set. The Bring It All Back Home remix for the 2003 re-releases. And the SACD for that. I also want to ask you more about SACD later. The Blonde on Blonde remix for 2003. And
that was incredible.
Yeah. The problem with talking about Dylan is there's every angle you can go down and every avenue you can go down and talk about for an hour, but I'm going to try to get to Time Out of Mind today. But it's great that you did that. You did Lovesick, so you touched Time Out of Mind earlier. You did the Victoria's Secret mix. One thing I saw somewhere, but then it didn't seem like I could verify it. Were you involved in Street Legal in any way?
Yeah, I remixed Street Legal too.
So was it the 99 remix when it got really redone, or was that something? Oh,
yeah.
So with Don DeVito, you were a partner with him somehow? Because his name is the one I saw.
Well, he's executive, he's A&R. He was A&R.
Oh, but you did it. Okay.
Yeah. Don DeVito isn't a mixer.
Okay. Sorry. I read it somewhere and it didn't have the credits right. So you did that. Oh, that's another one. A lot of these, what I want to ask you after watching a bunch of your stuff and what you're able to do now with new tools to, you know, rip stems out and do all this miraculous stuff is whether some of those old projects now you feel like you could do more and it'd be interesting to go back to.
I don't think I could do it any better, for sure.
And oh, it'd just be easier for you.
Yeah, I think it'd been easier to get to where I wanted to get to. But there was only one project where I only had a stereo to mix to work with, right? And that was the first project that, you know, when Dylan decides to go electric. That was the only one where I had basically a stereo instrumental and a vocal. So it was 3-track. And right. Yeah, that's a whole story in its own of the journey that I got to the point where I got, you know, chills.
All right. Well, so that's a big pile of Dylan projects that you've done. What's your personal history with Dylan, you know, just as a listener, as a fan before all that, or even
just like everybody else,
20 year
you know
period?
I mean, as I was growing up, you could either listen to Bob or the Stones or the Beatles, right? Or any of those bands that were out there at the same time, because I was growing up with all of that as they were growing up. And, just Dylan was just far and away on a completely different road than anybody else. And it was funny, it's like, you know, if you were against the rules, you tended to like the Stones more than, you know, than maybe the Beatles. And if you were getting into trouble, you found people say, "Are you listening to the Stones? Are you listening to, you know?" I don't think Dylan ever sat into any of those, you know, you're a good boy or a bad boy. But it was really, of course, it was ridiculous. But I listened to everybody. And like anyone else, I mean, I've had opportunity to mix two of the three artists that I've just mentioned, and even the third one, individuals from the band. So it was, you know, to be a guy who's like in a band playing these songs or just sitting back and just listening to these songs and then one day having your hands on it. I mean, that's why most of us become mixers. I mean, there is just nothing in the world like, you know, finally getting to mix an artist that, you know, you've had so much love with and you have so many memories from as you're growing up. So it was very, very special.
Cool.
And yet I have never met Bob. I've never been in the same studio, of course, since I've never met him. I've never spoken to him. I have no idea what he's thinking or whether he's ever liked it. I assume that if he didn't like it, I'd probably hear about it, but I can't assume that either, right? I'm not going to assume or dictate what he's thinking, right? Because that would be pretty stupid. So, but you know, if somebody from the camp hated what I was doing, I would have heard about it. But, you know, yeah, quite
you're
often
almost
I was,
10 projects in now.
Yeah. So I think at this point, you know, I'm probably okay. But, you know, Steve Berkowitz was always, you know, the one who represented the, you know, the camp pretty much, or the direction of what needed to be done. So, it was, you know, it was just an incredible year. I mean, to start with, you know, with just this iconic show where he, you know, the first set he's acoustic, and then the second set, his guys from the band, you know, or the future band comes on and he goes electric and everybody's going ballistic. What is this? You know, and other people are going, this is amazing. And I'm mixing this. And I'm like, oh my God, this is it. This was the night, you know.
Well, let's jump forward to Time Out of Mind and the new fragments, the new mix. So there's a lot there, because obviously this is really the first time, you know, Self-Portrait got redone in a way, in the Self-Portrait box. But to take an album that's this A, loved, and B, iconic in its own way, and remix it, you know, it's really a big issue. And I want to, you know, hear a little bit more about what you know about the thoughts of even taking on that project and doing it this way. I will say I've been able to listen for almost 2 weeks now. I just love it. It's interesting in a bunch of ways. It's interesting because it's cleaner and brighter, and there's just this, you know, sort of haze lifted in some ways. There's instruments that you didn't hear before. There's all kinds of changes that we'll talk about that are really great. And yet it doesn't feel like a different album.
That's right. There you nailed it.
It's really amazing. Even, you know, after I listened to it for a while and I went back to the old one, and then I made myself a playlist with both albums and I'd put it on shuffle to try to see if I could tell. And it's not easy. There's some tracks that's easy, and we'll talk about the difference, because I think some tracks are pretty subtle, the differences, and some tracks are more dramatic. But it's great that what I'm saying is a compliment, that the feel didn't change.
Yeah,
if you
right.
think about the new one and you dive in, especially I think, you know, either sort of more critical listening and maybe more better environment, there's tons of new stuff and it's really great. And yet you never think, you know, it's different. So anyway, I just want to tell you how much I love it.
Thank you.
Before we started talking about it.
But what you said is really important. And that was going to be my approach. I am one of those fans that hates a record that has been reinvented, remixed, when I grew up with every note, every feel, the whole emotion is attached to that record. It's not just the songs. It's the time in my life, right? And so we all have that feel that we're getting from a record. And if you take that away and you go into some other technical, to me it's technical, where you just change the environment, you change the approach. I hate it. I just turn it off because I'll just call it bullshit, right? And so I am not going to do that to myself. I am not going to do that with a record that's iconic. There is nothing wrong with Time Out of Mind. What Daniel Lanois did and Bob was brilliant. It's obvious it was brilliant because it just put Bob basically back where he should be, right?
Right.
So when we've been listening to that record, we know how it feels. I am not going to be the guy who changes that feel. I want to feel that humid midsummer, just dripping wet, almost, you know, New Orleans kind of swampy darkness, right? At times, and other times just this pain that he has in his voice. And, you know, so I'm like, okay. When I was approached to it, I said, look, you know, and they said, look, we know what you're going to do because we've heard you do other stuff for Bob. We want to hear your interpretation of it. And we want to keep it a little bit more simple, a little bit more singer-songwriter approach. And I thought, okay, but on some, I said, okay, and but the emotion, the feeling, the things, that the certain hooks that we all have lived with must be retained. But I'll bring the story out a little bit more. I'll bring, you know, I'll be able to, I think, find an approach where you're still getting all of that. You're maintaining the integrity of each song and you're getting the feel, but then I'll bring out the story a little bit better. And when I say better, I mean as an alternative approach, okay? There's nothing to be done that is better from what is already great. So I'll just use it in the sense of that approach. And then I think if it's done properly, you might just hear the story tied together a little bit better because Bob is telling a story, right? And I think that maybe I can do it in a way so that it starts to tie together. And so that was my initial thought. I was like, I'll do it with that in mind. If, you know, and then I said, if you're looking for something where, you know, I just go like crazy with it and stuff, I'm not going to do that because that'll be the first record that I would turn off. And I'm not going there. It's, if you see my discography as you know it, I'm into it from a musical standpoint. And, you know, and I want to respect, especially an iconic record, because those are tough to ever want to touch. Right. So I knew that those would have to be the conditions. And I also have my real close buddy, John Raphael, who just lives down the road from me, who's a huge music fan. I mean, he just has such a brain for all the records, all the years, and he knows every note of Dylan. And so I knew that at the point where I felt like I really had it going correctly, that it felt good to me and I was making Steve Berkowitz happy, then I needed to play it to him because he is you. He is the listener, right? I'm the listener too. I can stand back, but John doesn't care, knows nothing about what I do. He just loves music and he loves Dylan and he loves this record like big time. And so, you know, I think I waited until almost it was all done because I think maybe I played him a little bit. Yeah, I think I played him maybe Love Sick or something right at the beginning, you know, and he was just like, wow. Okay. You know, so I thought, all right, this is good. Because John will be the first one, if it ain't happening, is good, you know, go, what are you doing, man? What are you doing to me? You know, you're killing me here, right? And so it was really, it made me feel so good because I waited, basically it was all done and I sat him down here and I said, okay, listen, from beginning to end. And he was just beaming because, you know, it's exactly what I was hoping for. I brought out the connections of, you know, in his words, he said, bring something out new to each song. There's a now connected set of narratives that weave the sad outcome of a broken relationship, you know, were his words, which I had to write down because I'm like, he's so much more articulate about, you know, explaining the story or explaining how the record feels than I am. So why not use his words? But, I was just so happy because he goes, man, now I understand the story. Now I understand what Bob was saying, because they're all connected. And I was like, yes. And he goes, but it's so subtle, you know, except for, I think, what was it? I think it was maybe Cold Iron, you know, Bound, right? I think that one is the most obvious because I had the bass driving more and the drums are more powerful. But on the other hand, by doing that, it just brings the story out even more. You know, the
yeah,
the complications.
I thought the blues songs, you know, were much bigger than the more subtle ones. You know, I thought Lovesick was a little bit things like Trying to Get to Heaven and Make You Feel My Love are cleaner and nicer, but it's you know, it's not as dramatic. Cold Iron's Till I Fell in Love with You, I thought, you know, there's all kinds of instrumentation and popping and stuff going on there that wasn't before. Dirt Road Blues, phenomenal.
Yeah.
Incredible. Yeah.
Not Dark Yet came out really good.
Yeah. Oh, some reason I didn't write notes on that one, but yeah, you're right. It is great. So well, let me
tell you how this whole thing, how, what I had in front of me.
Yeah.
Because I haven't heard the track yet. So I'm assuming that what I get will be the stems of what you're hearing, right? If I put all the tracks up, I'm hearing the mix. And then of course, you know, the challenge is, well, how much processing do I have? Did Danielle print the effects right on the vocal? Did he print a lot of the cool stuff that he was doing? Is that printed or was that done at the mix? Right? Because if it's done at the mix, then I have flexibility. If it's all, you know, I put up the tracks and you know, it's processed and it's got all that stuff, then I have very little room, right? So I put up the tracks, and of course, C. Berkowitz has this, he's like a Sherlock Holmes, him finding these tapes. You know, there's so many variations.
Yeah, I was going to ask, because you got the original tapes, not digital versions. Or Steve,
well, I got tapes digital
for you.
Yeah, because the tapes had to be cooked, you know, baked and
yeah,
then, you know, put onto Pro Tools. And so, but he was able to find all of them, and almost on all except for maybe one song, all the tracks that appear in the mix are on the multi-track. There was one song where the intro has a hook. It was nowhere to be found. And I was like, well, I'm not mixing this song without that. Because if I were to hear this, I would go, the fuck? You know, what, you think you're cool to not to have the main hook going in this song, right? So I basically just extracted it from the record, from the stereo mix, the guitar, right, with Isotope.
Yeah.
Now I just had my guitar line. I laid that into the multi-track and then off and running, right? There's nothing that can't be done, and there's just no way that there's going to have to be an asterisk to explain why something isn't right. And I don't do that. I just figured it out.
So to clarify, you found that most of the effects weren't printed on the tape. You kind of had the raw tapes from everyone's.
And if they were printed, they were printed separately. So if there were effects maybe on the vocal was dry, but he had printed some of the effects on the side, right? But I think that on most of the songs, the direction was more to get the vocal to be a little bit, and I can't really say drier, but just to be a little more presentable in the sense of it being a little bit more natural. Okay. So I had that freedom because it wasn't printed, you know, with all the reverb or the delays or stuff. I could create all of that. And then at times when I wanted to match exactly what Danielle had done, I could just listen to it because I'm running the stereo mix in at the same time of the multi-track. So at any point, I'm always A-Bing, and I was A-Bing for hours. Because here's the issue that I had. When I put up the track, as I was saying earlier, I was expecting to hear just what was what was printed on the stereo. No. What I have is 5 to 6 guitar playing all the time, from soup to nuts, 2 keyboards, dobro, slide guitars, percussion, organ, Rhodes, you know, and parts. I mean, just all of those. And I was like, okay. Because some producers, they arrange everything right in the moment, right? They decide on the arrangement, who's going to play what in what section, who's not going to be playing. And then what you get was their creation of their arrangements. And then there's other producers who just say, look, everybody play. Here's the vibe we want. You play your thing. You play your thing. You play your thing. Everybody's playing. And then I'll decide at the time of the mix what stays and what goes. And that was the case. So
you had to rebuild it, basically.
So I had to rebuild it. But remember, I want to capture everything that I loved about that I heard in the original record, right? So certain guitar lines, certain vocal effects, or certain all the little things that I want to hear, I have to find those. And then, and so what I would do is I would start with the intro. And I would go through, I would just play the intro over and over and over, first four bars or eight bars. And I'm going through every track and hearing those, listening, memorizing them, and then deciding who are those that I like. And then I'll go to the Danielle's mix and I'll go, what did he decide on? And I'll go, okay, well, that's like really close to what I did. Okay, cool. I know what those tracks are. So for that first eight bars, we agree, right? But then I'll hear something that's really, really cool that could maybe enhance that section that wasn't on the record. So for now, I'll say, okay, everything that I don't like in this section, I'm going to mute. Start off that way. I'm just going with my instinct. I'm not second guessing anybody. I'm not trying to think who likes what, who doesn't. I don't care about any of that because you can never win in that. I'm just making me happy as a fan. So I'll decide what I like and what I don't like. And then I'll just check with Lenoir's mix and go, okay, how far off am I? Okay, well, cool. Oh, wow, I didn't hear that. Where is that? And then I'll look for that little part. I go, okay, I got that. That was only like in the whole song, there was only two bars, you know, from that particular performance, right? Like, okay, so I'll unmute that. And then I'll go to the first verse. Same thing. And then the second verse and the B section, you know, move on. And, you know, these are not 3-minute songs, right? So, you know, especially the one that's 15 minutes. And so I just keep going through all of that till I'm done, right to the end. So really it's a pre-production, it's pre-mixing, right? So once I've done all that and I'm like, okay, now let me just start mixing all those ingredients and see where I'm at. And again, one of the directions that I was given is keep it simple. Make it simpler than the original record, but still try and retain everything. Yeah. So then I started mixing and I'm thinking, okay, how do I feel? Do I feel that emotional stress, you know, the sadness? Am I getting that really hot, humid, you know, August day from this? Is it swampy enough, but not too busy? You know, and so that would always lead me to decide which direction to go in, right? And then at the point where finally I get from the beginning to the end, and I'm like, okay, this is cool. And I'm muting stuff because even with what I love now, I can't have all that playing all the time. Right. So I had to start removing stuff. That's why sometimes you'll hear like a bass pull out. Like, you know what? This is a good time to turn the bass off. This is like, this really just puts the highlight on that verse, on what he's trying to say. We don't need a bass right there. Right. So I would take that liberty because, you know, at worst, Steve would say, I don't know, that doesn't make sense to me, or, you know, we could discuss it and then I'll just put it back in if I needed to. But it was rare that he would do that. If anything, he'd want more taken out. You know, take more out. I'm like, oh man. You know, so this went on. I'd get through the song, and then I would just listen to it. And then I would listen to Danielle's mix from beginning to end and see how now all I'm doing is a feel thing. And am I missing anything important hooks? Like, are the things that I remember about this song? Because I have to refresh my memory on this, right? What about it is it that really was, what are the most important elements in here that made me feel the way I do? And then I go back to my mix and I'm like, you know, if I didn't get that feel, then I just dig back in and just keep doing things until it felt right. It had to be an enhanced feel of what we've all lived with. That was basically, you know, the direction.
Yeah. And I think that's exactly what it is. The extra instruments, you know, a lot of times to me, well, I want to talk about the voice and the vocal treatment. Primarily what this does is it brings those instruments forward. The voice was much further forward above everyone, and everyone else was kind of in a little ball in the back of the room before. And it feels like you've kind of expanded them and clarified them. And there are, you know, hi-hats and bass parts that are much more dramatic. It's interesting that the vocal stays still ahead. It's not, you know, Bob's never gets pushed back at all. But these other guys seem way up. And, you know, there is a lot more of the, I'm very interested in the guitarists, because when I talked to Mark Howard about the mix that he did, and as you may know, in the sort of political intrigue of this, a lot of those players were there because kind of Lanois brought his players and then Bob brought his players. And that's how there wound up being so many, you know, people in the room. And there was some arguments about who to turn off and who not to turn off. And that, you know, in those original mixes. And I think you brought a lot of people back that didn't maybe have as much time, you know, on the record before. So when I spoke with Mark Howard about the original process, he had described, you know, Danielle didn't really like the drummer, not the drummers, but there were two drummers also because of the Dylan Lanois thing. You know, Dylan had brought, Brian Blades came in on Lanois' side and Keltner came in on Dylan's behalf, and they just put them both on two sides and let them both play. And but the, you know, Cindy Cashdollar and Duke Robillard and Bob Britt, who's now playing with him again, that was the more contentious apparently original part of this, because Lanois didn't want that kind of, you know, strings acoustics. He wanted to do his, you know, his guitar work maybe, and that was all. So anyway,
fortunately, I don't know the history of that, and I wasn't precious to anybody. I wasn't aligned with anybody. I'm just trying to do the best thing I could do, you know, that just retains the original feel of this record.
Yeah. No, and it's great to get those new, you know, spices in it. Let's talk about Dylan's vocal for a second. So I thought the vocal happily was remarkably consistent. It's a little clearer. There's a little, you know, haze or fog off of it. I don't know what the technical term is, but it's clear to me. But it's not, you know, it's not radically different. Obviously, that would be, as you were talking about, a big thing that would really change this if his vocal, you know, sounded different.
It would distract us, right? It would distract us from him telling the story. And we all know how Bob's voice should sound. I mean, since I've done many of these, you know, so we want that. We all want that.
And the vocal amp that they used, there was, you know, a setup that Mark had built for him that apparently there was, you know, what he talked about, and I don't know if you got kind of the raw recording of both of these, was there was the his voice was going through this, what he called a vocal amp, and they would negotiate the percentage of vocal amp to non-vocal amp, you know, 50-50, 60-40, to give that tone to his voice. Did you have a pure clean vocal and one?
And that quite often was where I would get comments back going, no, I don't want, it's too much amp. I want no amp. I want it totally natural.
So that's where I probably, I think, ventured away from the original approach more often than not, where they really wanted a much more natural approach to the story than the amp.
Which would have been a bigger change. And I think you're right. It would have, yeah. I mean, I don't know how it would have sounded, but it would have been more distracting or jarring or just a different thing other than the same thing enhanced.
Yeah. So again, it and I'm listening to, there were times when I would hear the original mix and it was 60 amp and 30, you know, or 40 of the natural. And the comment, so I would kind of go in that direction and the comment would come back as, no, too much amp. We want, you know, 80 natural and 20 amp. I said, okay. So in the process of doing that, then I would see, well, how can I still feel kind of like that? And that's how I would treat the delays or the reverbs and maybe get a little more excitement. So you're still getting the essence of it, but in a more natural way, which would make the vocal more articulate, right? And so you're saying the clarity is like, well, if I don't have that distortion going on, then it's gonna sound a lot more articulate, clear. But on the other hand, I don't want it to sound flat and uninteresting. So
right.
Every song was, you know, a set of its own challenges.
When did this happen, by the way? When did the project start for you, and how long did it take?
That's a good question. Let me look. I can't believe you're right. I mixed it in December of 21.
How long did the whole process take for you?
It took almost a month, off and on. You know, it wasn't like every day. It was most of December and probably into January, February. You know, it just spread out, because usually I'm quite a fast mixer. I mix a song in 3.5-4 hours, and here I spent hours just on prepping, getting ready to mix, you know, deciding what the arrangement was going to be. So it just extended, and then there were comments, you know, there was maybe 2 revisions, 3 revisions. So it, you know, I ended up probably spending maybe 3 days per song.
And so did those come back through Bob's office or just through the engineering production chain?
As far as comments, yeah. Comments would be coming from Steve Berkowitz and Jeff Rosen. And, you know, and eventually it was usually make it simpler, you know? And then working on the sound of the vocal, because sometimes, you know, if I got it too close to the way it was done on the record, again, you know, they're looking for a much more natural approach, much more of a storytelling approach. So anytime that I start getting too effectsy, then, you know, I'd have to back off. So there was most of the comments that came in was really right around, you know, in that direction. Sometimes slide guitar, if it was playing too much of a melody, you know, I'd darken it, bring it down lower in the track. But for the most part, you know, 95% of what I had done, they were loving. There was the tweaks to just take it to where they felt was sometimes making Bob even louder than I thought was comfortable, right? But already I really wanted the band to be wrapped around him a bit more, right?
And so it does that, yeah.
So it's that becomes tricky, because obviously I don't want the listener to ever get distracted by the story he's telling. So at times I just kept bumping the vocal up a little bit louder, and then it still worked fine.
Were the two drummers on separate tracks? And
yeah.
How did? Yeah. Okay. And did
I think generally they were? Sometimes it would be stereo of each. Sometimes it might be mono. I don't really recall now, but I think there were probably two stereos. And sometimes there would be separation with a kick and a snare in addition to, you know, the stereo drums.
The clarity on the drums, and especially in the cymbals or whatever the components are there, is really one of my favorite things about it. A lot of times there's this nice little thing, and I'd have to go back to the old one, and it's there, but it's so deep you would never, you know, maybe find it. And all of a sudden now it's this constant, beautiful thing going on.
Yeah, I mean, again, there were so many great performances, and on certain songs, you know, like I don't know, let me just think which is the most obvious one. Cold Iron's Bound, right? I mean, that's where you really hear the bass and the drums just driving the song more. And that, you know, there were times where the difference between the original and what I had done was not subtle. But on the other hand, it's because I felt that the story was more aggressive and it just needed more of a support, you know, that just that nastiness needed to come out. You know, of course, growing up in New York City, I understand that quite well. And it was times when it was subtle, like you said, there were certain songs you go, wow, it just feels bigger, or maybe the vocal is more together. And other times they're like, wow. And it was in those moments where I would just check myself and go, all right, am I enhancing what I remember? Because what's great about the brain, right, and your memories is if you're enhancing something that you loved, it's going to work, right? If you wanted to hear that aggression and now you're hearing it much more, your memory still connects to those feelings, to those emotions, right? So if I'm bringing the emotion of this song out more, and you go back and you go, wow, I remembered it much, you know, more like what I'm hearing now. And yet you go back to the original mix, you go, what? Actually, it was much more subtle. So those are the moments where I'd say, no, I think this is going to be okay. I just didn't want to be that guy where somebody goes, I hate these mixes. It's just a whole other thing. It's taking it away from the original, you know. I mean, I'm sure I'm going to get haters anyway. You can't go beyond that. But that was always on my mind. I was one of those people talking to myself, you know, going, are you going too far? You know?
Well, I think the reason it works, as I said at the beginning, is almost that I still want to listen to the old one. And I want to listen to this. It's just different. And I know that was the goal. I mean, I do think it's, you know, objectively better, clearer, higher fidelity, different instruments, lots of things. I don't think the old one gets put away, you know, and I think I really have even a question, not so much for you, but it'll be for everyone, is about how much of the, let's just call it the Lenoir effect or magic on that first album was in that fuzz or that haze, ghost, whatever.
Totally.
That's over it. And it maybe it needed that for the first 25 years. And now we have that, like you say, we have that baked in. So it's cool to now hear the guitars and the bass and the hi-hats much clearer because it's on top of years of the other thing.
Understand that I'm not thinking about it that way. I'm not thinking, oh, I think we should make things brighter. I'm just mixing it for me. I'm mixing it the way I like to hear it. And if something sounds too dark or too dull, when I think that the emotion could be even better expressed by having the drums, you know, feel, you don't want like drums louder, but no top end, right? So I'm not necessarily thinking at all about it. I'm just remembering how it felt to me in my own way and hoping that, you know, like top end doesn't distract the listener from it either, right? So again, it was a constant, you know, back and forth, you know, am I going too far? But again, I was like, do I feel good? Yes. Okay. I have nothing else to go on. I have nothing else. That's as a mixer, I don't know how to do anything else. If I don't feel good, I'm nowhere.
And as you know, right, we don't have the kind of auditory memory. This is why it's so interesting to go back and forth. And like I said, play a mix with both versions in there.
Right.
You're in there and you're like, well, this seems good. And then it took me a while to get to like 90%, where I could say, no, that's old or that's new. But it wasn't, oh, this is, you know, again, bad or good. They're just different. And I think it's fine if, you know, whatever set of decisions drove it now. Look, the brightness is, and all the clarity, I'm not being limiting with that word, is it's clearly appealing. And like, it just feels so good to hear that clarity and those instruments and even Bob's voice with, you know, I would say it's only 2, 3, 4, 5% of stuff unwrapped from Bob's voice, but that's a lot. It still sounds like Bob's voice. Yeah. You get this little extra.
Yeah.
It's great.
But I think what's great, what you're saying too, Craig, is that if you're listening and you go, wow, I don't really notice the difference, but it feels really good, then that's it. That's all I wanted, yeah. Right? And I'm not trying to copy it. I'm just trying to give you my interpretation as a fan, as a fan of this record, and just give you what, you know, how I feel about it, and hope that it's still maintaining all the integrity that it deserves, right?
I think most people, you're right, you can't get 100%. I think most people are going to be really happy. Anyway, I think people are going to love it, and this is a tough room, as you know.
that's what's important to me is that I'm in that same room. Yeah. I'm the guy that would be really, really tough, you know, and so I had to really believe that what felt good was okay.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't disrespecting the song, you know, and I have nothing. I can only do that.
Let me ask you about Highlands. As you say, it's, you know, 17.5 minutes or whatever it is. There's a loop that wasn't played live that they played over, and then obviously there's live folks playing. Was there anything different for you about reconstructing that one? I think it's one that is in the lower percentage of dramatic change in this one. But how was it working on that song? Was there anything different about the pieces you had to build that song or rebuild that song?
I just remembered it as, okay, he's got a story to tell. It's a long one. How do I keep the listener interested? And you'll see, you know, obviously as you listen, the arrangement changes way, way more than the original. Mm. I have a lot of things that keep cutting out, coming back in, bass coming out, organs in, organs out, you know. Oh,
okay, I'm going to have to pay closer attention.
Yeah, when you listen to that, the arrangement has changed dramatically, and yet you don't really notice. So
yeah,
that's a good thing. That's a good thing.
Yeah,
that's all I know. I was like, wow. How do I keep myself interested for 17 minutes? And it's not to say that there isn't a great story being told. I'm just saying, okay, how do you support this story and not feeling like there's, you know, 15 verses to get through? And it's all, of course, without a great story, who cares? But there still has to be some interest changes going on subtly, just to help enhance the different sections of where he's going in this story, right? And those were times too with where Steve would say, you know what, this is a section where this instrument shouldn't be in there because it's really important to focus on exactly what he's saying at this point in the story, right? And so that would be a good example where things were really removed or lowered drastically. And then you're just naturally focusing on now Bob.
Did you only get the tapes that corresponded to the original album, or was there any talk of, I know other people did the outtakes, but was there any talk of playing with the track listing and adding some of those songs?
Nope.
Yeah.
No, never. Not for me. My job was strictly reinterpret Time Out of Mind. on the songs and as the original tapes.
Is your sense that the fact that this was done in 2021 and 2022 impact what was possible? Meaning, could Mark and Dan have made different choices back then if they wanted to achieve the same result? Or did technology enable you to do things that 25 years ago would have been less likely?
No, they were recording it live, right? And from what I heard, they went to many places to record this record. This wasn't all done in 1 week, right? They went to,
it was a bunch in California and then down in Miami and then back to California. Yeah.
And so getting the troops together and getting everybody in the same room and Daniel recording everybody so at least he could decide later, nothing would have changed. I mean, you'd have to ask Daniel Lenoir what he would have done differently. And as far as I'm concerned, I had the multi-track. I had individual recording, you know, of the instruments, the isolation. You'd originally asked, was there a lot of leakage on his vocal? And then I think we got, internet went down or something. There was a ton because he's in the room. So I was dealing a lot with that. And if I was going to take instruments out, you know, was it still going to be there in his vocal? So there was a fair amount of my removing the leakage, or when he wasn't singing at times, I would, you know, remove his vocal, the leakage of the vocal, but you got to be careful with that because that could be the vibe of that mix, and you take that out, and suddenly you just go, what's happening here? Something just changed, you know? So
yeah, that was Mark Howard's opinion, was that those ghost players who we faded out, but they lived in the leakage, was kind of part of the atmosphere.
Absolutely. I mean, everything worked. I didn't try to clean up for the sake of cleaning up. I only cleaned up if it was like, well, you know, I just took out an instrument. I still hear it and Bob's not singing. So maybe I'll just lower it enough so that I can, you know, still get the vibe.
Let me ask you some kind of geeky things. Some of this is mixing, some of it's mastering, and I'm probably not technical enough to know where different parts live, but do you have to think about the CD versus the vinyl versus the stream?
No.
Differently? Is that all done after your process?
No, and the mastering was done very, very flat. It was, you know, it was done, it was practically flat. So as far as if it's going to be for a vinyl, that can, at mastering, that might have a different EQing done so that it works for vinyl. Generally, there's a vinyl mastering. And then there's a, you know, normal 44.1 mastering. And then sometimes if it's strictly for, you know, Spotify or something, sometimes there's a separate mastering for that too.
And then you mentioned before that there was an Atmos mix done. So
right.
how did that fit in this process? And tell us how you feel about the results of that. Is that
so
sort of a compelling, that's almost a third version of the album or a third mix.
Yeah.
You know, the original and yours, and now there's an Atmos mix.
There was, once all the mixes were approved, then on, I think, a month later or two or something, they said, hey, you know what? We want an Atmos version of this. I was like, okay. So at that point, I had everything mixed, so all I had to do was just run stems, right? And so my mix is being printed. If you put all the, you know, I don't have to have the effects. Again, everything is being printed that I've mixed. So the drums and the bass and the guitar, everything separately is mixed as stems. And then we would take all of that and then spread it around in the Atmos, which is where, with Fernando Reyes, my former assistant, and still occasionally my still present assistant, I really, I really like working with him for all these years. And he was studying, learning Atmos. And I said, okay, why don't we co-mix Atmos together? Because, you know, Atmos is cool, but, you know, you're into it. And it'll be a good opportunity to do something, to continue doing something together, right? So that's what we did. And so he took the stems and he would work on it, you know, just to get it spread out. And of course, I'm going to be listening, once he's got it, I'm going to be listening to the stereo mix version of it against what he's done, which is being rendered down to stereo, because I'm not doing it with all the speakers around me and with him speakers. We don't, neither of us are going to do that. It's just, let's see what it sounds like on headphones, right? And so I'd be going back and forth, just making sure that my mix is still, you know, you can relate to it. Because when you're spreading stuff around, you know, the phasing is insane. And then there's the Sony version and there's the Atmos version. And then, you know, the vocal sits in different places. It's quite a challenge. So, I would be happy with that. Then he, you know, I would say, well, obviously in headphones, you can't hear things climbing up on you. You really don't hear things going from front all the way to the back. You get a sense of it, right? But, obviously you don't really hear things moving around behind you. And I didn't want it to be like a travel show, you know, I didn't want it to be a novelty IMAX movie kind of thing where, you know, you get stuff crossing over. I mean, we'll do stuff where it's appropriate, but otherwise what I really want to do is just get more of a huge panoramic sense of the record, right? So it's more immersive. So you're really sitting in the record and still keep it as musical as possible and not get tricky and get stupid. You know, it's Bob Dylan, you know? So we did that. And so once it was done, we went to Flux Studios, right? And where they've got all the speakers in their Atmos room. And then I'm listening, and probably the first couple of songs needed the most work, but it was a global thing. Like, okay, you know what? There's not enough going on in the background. Let's move stuff in the back. Let's add some more vocal in the center channel. So I want him just feeling like it's kind of a pyramid. You know, he's talking to me, he's singing to me a little bit more close. So, you know, there were just minor tweaks because we've already been working Atmos together for a while. So we have, you know, every time we go in, we're like closer and closer and closer, which blows my mind because we've been doing this on headphones and Fernando has such a good imagination of where everything actually really is. And we go in and we tweaked it, and it's just really, really fun. I mean, it still feels like the record, and it doesn't feel tricky. You know, it's just more immersive.
So how much better is the Atmos when you're able to go to a studio and there's all those speakers versus the, you know, AirPods simulation?
There's no comparison.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. I don't care what anybody says. I mean, it's just no comparison. You can't have 9 different objects, different speakers suddenly come into, you know, a rendered stereo and expect to hear and feel any of that. And you're working with crazy ass phasing issues when you're summing everything down, or that there's this calibration stuff going on that is, you know, creating all of this so you can hear it, you know, on headphones. I mean, you know, all the processing that's going on in there is insane.
All right. So I've got to find a real Atmos room to hear that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I worked with somebody recently who just, you know, was really freaking out because He's like, wow, it sounds great in the room. Wow, this is fantastic, you know, and I'm just so disappointed when I'm hearing it in the headphones. And again, it's subject related to how much music are you know, what kind of record are you working with? I mean, and I'm not saying that it doesn't sound great and you can't do cool stuff, but it does not sound like when you're listening into an Atmos room. It just can't.
Yeah.
I mean, it just can't. Not yet, anyway. I mean, there's no such thing as can. I'm sure there'll be a day where you go, wow, this is unbelievable. I don't, you know, this is just like being in the same room. But that day has not come yet.
Listen, thank you for all these years of helping us listen to Dylan. Congratulations on this new work. I think, I think people are going to love it. I'm absolutely loving it. And thanks for doing the work on this. Thanks for being willing to come today and talk about it. It's been fantastic. We'll all look forward to the world getting to hear your work from Friday.
And then let me know how the reactions are. Rather, yeah. I'd be very interested, obviously, because I kept all of us in mind when I was mixing this. So I'd be interested in seeing if, like yourself, you know, whether the reaction is positive.
Yeah. Well, I'll send you some notes from the corners of the internet where they obsess about these things. You know, there'll be a 700 page thread assessing your work about 2 weeks from now. So, all right. Well, again, thank you, Michael Brower for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for listening.